All right, hi everybody. Thank you so much for coming out tonight. It's really nice to see a lot of familiar faces and meet some people who I've seen many, many times but haven't necessarily had opportunity to schmooze with. I'm Dina Black, in case we haven't met before. And my husband Avi is the new assistant rabbi here. And it's been really great getting to know the community for the last 6 months, and we felt very warmly welcome, so thank you all for that. And I'm really excited to have this opportunity to learn with everyone tonight. So I was once sitting at a meeting at school. I work at Mayanot Yeshiva High School for Girls in Teaneck, and I teach Gemara and American History there, and I'm also the director of student programming, one of the directors of student activities, basically, just a different title. So I was sitting with my we were trying to figure out a way to get a certain grade to be more cohesive. They were having some clique issues, some social dynamics issues, high school girls, and my co-director of student activities said, we have to take them out of school to a campsite or some isolated location for a day or 2 days overnight and create like a really intense experience for them, send them, you know, orienteering, send them into the woods with compasses and make them find their way back, create some sort of really intense experience for them together. Like put them in a room together, you know, an escape room type thing, don't let them out, make them figure it out. And that's what's going to help them bond and cohere as a group. No matter what we try to do, if it's in the school building, in their typical setting, it's just not going to work. Like we have to create this intense experience for them. And this resonated with me because I think this is really true in general in life. Experiencing something powerful with someone or with a group of people definitely creates a certain type of bond, right? Camp, for those of us who went to sleepaway camp, it's just this being away in this isolated environment, it just creates a bond that you don't necessarily get in another type of setting. It just creates a certain bond and a certain feeling of connection. But what I want to talk about is how do we create those types of bonds and those types of deep, meaningful relationships in the context of our normal lives and our day-to-day lives and maintain them. And although this is not directly related to my field of expertise, which is Tahara Mishpacha as a Yoatz HaHalacha, many questions that Yoatzot get really are getting at the crux of this issue, and much of our work as Yoatzot is helping couples sort of enhance their relationships in the day-to-day. So this is really the question that I want to explore tonight through studying some texts together. How do we create and maintain meaningful and deep and lasting relationships within our normal lives and our normal routines? So if you look at source number one, it's a fairly common phenomenon within Chazal to sort of talk about what's the most important mitzvah? What's sort of the mitzvah that like represents our ideals and that sort of encompasses everything? So this, sometimes Chazal lists mitzvot as keneged kulam. They sort of like encompass all our values and all mitzvot, right? Famously, we say it every day in Birchot HaTorah, the Mishnah, and Peah says, Talmud Torah keneged kulam. Learning Torah sort of matches up to everything else. And one example of such a debate in Chazal could be seen in this Midrash, in source number one, that discusses a pasuk in Parshat Tetzaveh, which happens to be this week's Parsha. And we don't actually have this Midrash in any of our collections of Midrashim, but it's quoted in the Ein Yaakov, which is a 16th century work. And here, this is he quotes this midrash in the introduction to his work. So he says, Ben Zoma Omer, I'm in source number one, Matzino pasuk kolel yoter, v'hu Shema Yisrael Hashem Elokeinu Hashem Echad. The pasuk that's like it represents everything we stand for, is Shema Yisrael Hashem Elokeinu Hashem Echad. God is one, right? Monotheism. So that sort of makes sense. We get that, why that would be like very fundamental, right? Benanas Omer, Benanas said, Matzinu pasuk kolel yoter v'hu v'havta l'recha kamucha. We have the pasuk, that's it, it's the one, it represents sort of everything we stand for. Love your neighbor as yourself, right? Interpersonal relationships, you have to really make sure that you care about people and that you're a sensitive person. That also sort of makes sense why that would be it, right? That would be the one thing that we choose to be sort of representative of everything. But then Shimon ben Pazi says, Matzinu pasuk kolel yoter, v'hu era keves ha'achad ta'aseh b'boker, v'ira keves ha'sheni ta'aseh ben ha'arbayim, that you should slaughter one sheep in the morning and one sheep in the afternoon. This is the pasuk that commands us to bring the korban tamid, right? The daily offering that was brought in the Beit HaMikdash, once in the morning, once in the afternoon. We have shachar and mincha that correspond to those. He says this is the pasuk that represents everything that we stand for. It's fundamental. So this seems kind of strange at first glance. Why is the Korban Tamid so important that it deserves that sort of status of being the cornerstone of our entire Avodat Hashem? So I think the answer is fairly obvious. And what this pasuk symbolizes is that it emphasizes our ongoing commitment to God. Reaffirmed every day, twice a day, right, and three times a day for Maariv, which is, Maariv corresponds to the the like leftovers that were burnt on the Mizbeach after the Korban Tamid Shel Shachar and the Korban Tamid Shel Bein Arbayim. But it emphasizes, right, our ongoing commitment to God every day, as part of our daily routine, right? It's relatively easy, to demonstrate our devotion to God in the midst of moments of inspiration and spiritual loftiness, right? Like Mamad Har Sinai was this sounds and light show. It's easier to feel a connection and to feel a sense of spirituality in a situation like that. Or during the Chagim season, right? During the Chagim season of Tishrei, when we have Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur and Sukkot, it's kind of all building up. We can feel, maybe it's easier to feel connected. We're like on Yom Kippur, the holiest day of the year. Or, right, God forbid, in the midst of a crisis, sometimes people are able to experience that more. You know, the famous phrase, there's no atheist in a foxhole, and people are able to sort of, like, when they have nowhere else to turn to God. But it's much more difficult to do that, to continue to do that every single day, day after day, day in and day out, morning and night. And that's what the Korban Tamid requires of us. The Korban Tamid requires of us to show that commitment, to be committed like that, every day, day after day. And that's why, according to Ben Pazi, that's the cornerstone of our entire Avodat Hashem. And although, again, we don't have the Korban Tamid today, as I said before, the Gemara in Brachos teaches us that we have Tefillah, there's a Machloka in the Gemara in Brachos, whether Tefillah is parallel to the Avot, right? Like Avraham Daven Shachar, so we Daven Shachar, so Yitzchak Daven Mincha, so we Daven Mincha, or Tefillah Keneged Korbanot. Do we have Shachar because we don't have the Korban Tamid, so we have to have something else in its place? And that's one of the options of the Gemara and Brachot, that we have davening in place of Korbanot today. And I think the same difficulty that probably existed with the Korbanot Tamid, right, that they were sort of routine day after day, the same thing definitely exists with Tefillah. I work in a high school, so I definitely see this, but I think it's true with adults as well. But in the school that I work in, and I think in all schools, there are lots and lots of conversations go on about this issue as it relates to high school students. How can we make davening more meaningful? How can we, you know, make the whole experience more spiritual? How can we get the students more into it? But I don't think this difficulty is unique to that high school population. I think it's true for every single one of us, regardless of our stage of life. Connecting to God when we're experiencing something lofty or a spiritual high or a time of stress is natural. Maintaining that connection on a daily basis is much more difficult. So, in fact, the Gemara in Kiddushin, if you look at source number 2, famously says, I think this is pretty famous, right? The Gemara says, "Gadol mitzuveh ve'otza, mimisha eino mitzuveh ve'otza." So the source number 2 is a commentary on that, but just background is that the Gemara says that someone who does something because he or she is commanded to do it is greater, whatever greater means, maybe it means you receive more reward, than someone who does something that he or she is not commanded to do. And the Ritva, a commentary on the Gemara from 13th century Spain, he explains that it means getting more schar, it means you get more reward, and that the reason is because it's hard to find meaning in something and therefore to continue to do something that is commanded of you day after day. So let's look at it together inside. Right, he says, "Ka'amar Rabbi Chanina, gadol ha-metzuveh ve'osah yoter mimisha'inu metzuveh ve'osah." Someone who does something that they're commanded to do is greater than someone who does something they're not commanded to do. "The Rabbeinu ha-gadol pirish, so he's quoting the Ramban here, Rabbeinu HaGadol is the Ramban, and he says that mitzvot, when God gives us mitzvot, it's not for his benefit, it's for us. Someone who is commanded fulfilled the decree of the king. Therefore, his reward is greater than someone who didn't fulfill the decree of the king. Because when you're, right, what he's saying is when you do it because you're commanded to, you're really doing something just because you were told to do it. Not because you necessarily find meaning in it, but because it's what you were told to do. Whereas if you do it even when you weren't commanded, so you're doing it because you connect to it, you find meaning in it, you want to do it, but it's not as great as doing something just because it's what you're supposed to do. Mikol makom, he says, af hu ratwe lekabel schar, right? Still, the person who's not commanded still deserves schar. Because he did this out of the goodness of his heart. He put himself in a situation of following God's will. So he still deserves schar, but not as much as someone who did it, but just out of being commanded to do it. So it's hard to do something day after day after day because it's a responsibility. It's something that we have to do. And not necessarily something that we're always going to find meaningful. And that's why that's really appreciated when we continue to do something that we don't necessarily find meaningful. And we're doing it because we're commanded to do it. And our natural inclination might be, we don't feel like it. We want to stay in bed. We don't want to do it. We don't connect to it. We're not in a mood, but we do it anyway. And that's difficult. That's hard. And God sees that as something that deserves appreciation and reward and respect. So I think that, tying it back together to source number one, I think that's the message of the Korban Tamid, that it's, right, it's Tamid, it's always. Maintaining a relationship requires investing effort in it, even when it's challenging, and even when it requires ongoing physical, mental, and emotional presence. And the same is true for our relationship with God, that in order to maintain a close relationship, we have to actually be there, we have to be present, we have to show up, we have to be there every single day, even when we're not in the mood. We might not feel a spiritual high from davening every single time we do it. In fact, I would venture to say we won't feel a spiritual high every single time we do it. But we have to, right, and that's okay, that's normal. It's not realistic to expect that that's what we're going to feel, but we still have accomplished having God be a presence in our daily lives and being a constant in our daily lives. And I think there are many other mitzvot that get at this ideal as well. Right, we don't just want to involve God in our lives at times that are spiritual peaks, like Shabbos once a week, or like Chagim, you know, every couple of months. We want to have God be a constant presence in our daily routine. So we take very sort of routine, mundane activities of daily living, and we bring God into them by putting them in a certain framework, a certain context that elevates them, right? Like, for example, eating, right? Eating is very, like, primal activity, something that we need to do to survive. But by having the laws of Kashrus and the laws of Shechita, we sort of elevate that to something sanctified. I think it's no coincidence, actually, that the Rambam has his Mishnah Torah, which is his work of halacha, his code, and he divides it into 14 categories. And in each category, he talks about, like, different topics. So let's say in Zmanim, right, times of the year, he talks about all the different holidays and Chagim. So the one that he calls Kedusha, what would you think would be in the one he calls Kedusha? What would you, if you had a guess, what would you think would be in there? What would he talk about?
Karbanot.
What else? Marriage. Okay. Right? So none of those are what's in there. What's in there is are the things that are sort of the most, like, primal activities of daily living that are, you know, like, common to man and beast in the language of Rav Soloveitchik, that we elevate to something sanctified, to something kadosh, right? It's in the Sefer Kedusha, by putting it in a context, in a framework with boundaries and halachot about how we do it, what we do and what we don't. It's the halachot of shechita, which have to do with eating. It's the halachot of isurei bia, right? Forbidden sexual relationships and what's permissible and who's permitted to whom. And machal rasirot are the other hilchot kashrut other than shechita, right? All the other laws relating to what we're allowed to eat and what we're not allowed to eat. So I think that really also emphasizes this point in the Rambam. So it's this idea of incorporating God as a constant in our lives and not only striving for religious growth sort of at once-in-a-lifetime moments and experiences that's symbolized by the Korban Tamid, and therefore makes the Korban Tamid, I think, worthy of being this cornerstone of the entire, of the entire Torah and of our Avodah Hashem. So now we understand that sort of maintaining this relationship on a daily basis is a really important value, and it's sort of something that we're supposed to strive for. But how do we do it? How do we keep this going when we're not experiencing a moment of spiritual, a moment of spiritual loftiness? How do we keep it up in our relationship with God? And then we'll sort of also translate that into how we keep that going in our relationships with other people. So what I want to do in order to sort of develop an idea about how we could do this is explore together a sugya, a topic in Masechet Kiddushin that I think will shed some light on this question. So if you look at source number three, is a Mishnah in Kiddushin that says, Ha'ish mekadesh bo b'shlucho, a man can marry a woman, both himself or with a messenger, right? He can go and give her the ring himself, or he can send a messenger to do it. Background that makes this make a little bit more sense. Everyone's thinking to themselves, like, what? He's not going to show up to his own wedding. In the times of the Gemara, there are two stages to the Jewish marriage process. What's called Kiddushin, which is the giving of the ring, and then Nisuin, which is the sort of starting to live together as husband and wife. Nowadays, we do that all at the same time. We have the chuppah, where he gives the ring, and then they're under the chuppah, and they say the Shabbat Brachot, and they go to the Yichud room, and we sort of do all those that whole process one after the other. In the times of the Gemara, they potentially could have done these two things up to a year apart from each other. He could have sort of set her aside as his wife by giving her the ring, but she would stay living in her father's home, and only a year or right a few months or a year later, they would start to live together as husband and wife. So let's say he lived in Australia and she lived in New York, and he couldn't get to New York, but he was afraid, you know, like someone else was going to get to her first. So he wanted to, you know, marry. He wanted to make sure that he did kiddushin with her. So he sent a messenger to do it. Okay. So the Mishnah says that works. That's valid. You could do that. And ha'isha mitkadeshet ba'u b'shlucha, a woman could do the same. She could also send a messenger to receive the kiddushin. Okay, the Gemara wants to know, if you could do it with a messenger, isn't it sort of obvious that you could also do it yourself? Like, why does the Mishnah need to use that extra word, bo, right? Ha'ish mekadesh bo u'bishlucho, he could do it himself or with a messenger. Why couldn't it just say, ha'ish mekadesh bishlucho, that he could do it with a messenger, and we would sort of know, obviously, you could also do it yourself if you could do it with a messenger. And the Gemara says, I'm on the second line of source 3, where it says, Gimel Mem Gemara, now that we know that he could do it with a messenger, is it really necessary to teach us he could do it himself? And Rav Yosef says, Amar Rav Yosef, mitzvah bo yoter mibishlucho. It's more of a mitzvah if he does it himself. That's what the Bo is teaching us. If it would have just said you could do it with a messenger, you would have thought it's equally as good to do it with a messenger or yourself. And the fact that it teaches us that you could do it yourself is there to teach us that it's better to do it yourself. Yeah, you could use a messenger if you have no other choice, but it's better to do it yourself. So, two questions to explore about this concept. First of all, why? Why is it better to do it yourself? And number two is, what does this apply to? So if we look at the rest of the Gemara, just to finish this up, the Gemara gives another example of this principle applying. It says, Kiha derav safra machrich resha rava malach shibuta. That was the end of source 3 on page 1. It's better to do kiddushin yourself, just as Rav Safra would grind the head, and Rava would salt the fish. And Rashi says they're talking about for Shabbos, right? These two rabbis in the Gemara, they would involve themselves in the Shabbos preparations, because it's more of a mitzvah to give that kavod to Shabbos yourself than to have someone else do it, whether it's your wife, your kids, your housekeeper. These rabbis would involve themselves in that process, because it's more of a mitzvah to do it yourself. So, two questions again. Why? Why is it better to do it yourself? And two, What does this apply? Is it only true about the example specifically listed in the Gemara of marriage and getting ready for Shabbos, or is it a more broad concept? So first we'll look at some discussion about why. So if we turn the page to page 2. So Rashi says, why? Mitzvah bo yoter mibishlucho, d'chi asik gufo b'mitzvos mekavel schar tvei. If you involve yourself, your own body, in the mitzvot, you're going to get more schar, more reward. So Rashi says, it's about you getting more reward, that's why it's better to do it yourself. Source number five, the Rambam says, v'kach hikdim ba'al shlucha, the reason that the Mishnah gives us the word ba before shlucha, or bo before shlucho, same idea, v'fi shehit askur ha'adam b'mitzvah, ba'atzmo yoter mitshalim me'asher yatil al zulato la'asotalo. If you involve yourself in the mitzvah, the Rambam says, it's going to be more complete than if you have someone else do it for you, right? The famous phrase, if you want it done right, do it yourself. So it's, to me, that's how I read this Rambam, that if you want the mitzvah to be done as completely as you envision it, the way that you want it done, you have to do it yourself. So, and that's why it's better to do it yourself, because it will get done better. If you look at source number 6, the Chida, he brings a slightly different perspective, and he says, if you don't do it yourself, nir'eh kemit'atzel b'mitzvah, it looks like you're being lazy. U'mechle kemizalzel b'mitzvah, she'ina chashuva b'einav kolkach, leilechu ba'atzmo la'asotai. It looks like it's not important enough to you, it's very disrespectful to the mitzvah, because it looks like it's not important enough to you to actually get up and put in the effort to do it yourself. It looks like you're just lazy, and you're like, I don't really feel like, you know, doing this, so you go do it for me. It's not so nice. It's a little bit disrespectful, the Chida says. So, we sort of have two different categories. Some of the explanations as to why this is better are about you and the effect it's going to have on you. It's better for you. And some of them are about the mitzvah, right? It's better for the mitzvah to do it yourself. And not necessarily about the impact that it's going to have on you. One possible sort of practical difference that comes out of that is, let's say it's not better for the mitzvah to have you do it. Let's say it's better to have someone else do it. So that the Chida talks about that in source number 7, right? Ve'im ha'acher hu adam gadol, if the other person is someone really important and a great person, yesh lomar dekesho usah uto shaliach in shum pikpuk mitzad mitzvah, then it's not disrespectful to the mitzvah, because you're actually like getting someone to do it who you think is this great person, that's why you want them involved, because you care so much about this mitzvah that you want this great person involved in it with you. Because only it's actually more respectful to the mitzvah to have someone so important, right, participate in it with you. And the Maharach or Zeruah, source number 8, gives a specific example. He gives the example of Shechita, and then at the end, he also gives the example of a bris, right? How many people here have sons? How many people here has your husband do the bris? Okay. Most people. My husband wants to be a Moel. He's actually shadowed some Moelim over the years, but he's never actually done a bris. And when I was pregnant with my son, we didn't know it was going to be a boy, but everyone's like, oh, if it's a boy, you're going to, you know, you're not going to let him do it, are you? And I said, if he was at the point where he was comfortable doing it, then I would let him, because I know that he's not going to do it unless he knows what he's doing. But most people, right, are not Moelim, and most people are not going to do the bris. But it's the mitzvah on the father, is it a mitzvah on the son, the baby, and someone's just helping him take care of it. Regardless, it's definitely not, the mitzvah is not on the moel, right? But the moel is hired as a shaliach, as a messenger, as an agent to fulfill the mitzvah on behalf of whoever's obligation it is, whether it's the father or the son. But that's actually not disrespectful to the mitzvah. That's more respectful because it's going to be done a lot better, a lot more completely, a lot more right if you hire a professional to do it, right? And same thing with shechita. The Maharach or Zeruah gives that example. None of us know what we're doing with shechita. It's not respectful to the mitzvah to do it ourselves. It's more respectful to hire someone who's a professional. So if it's about the mitzvah, then those examples would be different. Whereas if it's about us, so then even if it's not going to be done as well, it's still going to have greater impact on us if we do it ourselves. So that would sort of be a practical difference between these different approaches. Practically speaking, everybody agrees you should hire a moel and not do it yourself if you don't know what you're doing. Right, shechita too, definitely. Okay, so, but maybe the why of this really actually depends slightly on the what, right? If it's just about these two mitzvot in particular, that might shed a light as to why this concept is important. Whereas if it's more broad, we might look at it slightly differently. So let's look at a few sources about to which mitzvot this applies. And the Tosfot Riyah Zakein, one of the Balei HaTosfot, in source number 9 on page 2, he says, "Kol mitzvah shemutelet alav ya'aseh begufo lo yedei shaliach." Every mitzvah, any mitzvah that is upon you, that rests, the obligation of it rests upon you, you should do yourself. So he doesn't think it just applies to these mitzvot mentioned in the Gemara. He thinks it applies to everything, all mitzvot. The Shulchan Aruch in source number 10 agrees, right? He brings the story of the Rush, who also was a Rishon a little bit earlier than the Shulchan Aruch. And he says, the Rush, Hayamish Tadel, the Matzat Mitzvah, the Omid Al Asiyata, Umizariz, Hauskim Behem, Umusayeb, Arichatan, that the Rush would like stand around when the people were making the matzah and sort of like cheer them on, give them moral support and participate in the process because he wanted to be personally involved. The Chayin Ra'ui, the Chol Adam La'asot, Li'itapel Hu Ba'atzmo B'mitzvah. The Shulchan Aruch says, that's appropriate for everyone to do. Everybody should get personally involved. So here it's about matzah. It's not about any of our examples in the Gemara. So clearly the Shulchan Aruch thinks it's more broad. The Chacham Shlomo, who's a commentator on the Shulchan Aruch, though, he says, right, V'yesh Lomar, D'dafka B'Kiddushin V'Shabbos Hadin Kein V'lo B'Shar Mitzvos. Maybe it's specific to Shabbos and Kiddushin and not, it doesn't apply to other mitzvos. So, again, maybe this distinction actually, right, sheds light on the reason. So, if we say that it's about all mitzvot, right, regardless of whether it's about you or if it's about the mitzvah, it says something about how we're supposed to relate to mitzvot. And it's not just the technical 613 mitzvot, but all sort of acts of religious observance, even if they're not technically on the list. Right? There's something about engaging in these activities ourselves that is important, and yes, it's important to sort of like check it off the list that you did it, but there's something about engaging in these activities ourselves that it has value, right? And that helps us achieve more than just checking those obligations off the list. And this is a theme that Rav Soloveitchik really heavily emphasized and developed in various places, that serving God is not just about the technical, dry details of making sure that you fulfill all the technical requirements. It's an experience. It's a feeling and an experience that you sort of have to create. And I think source number 12, which is his hesped for the Talmud Rebbetzin, who is his machtinista, is a really good example of this. So just as an introduction to this, I'll sort of a background. In this, we'll see he sort of develops like a role for a Jewish father and a role for a Jewish mother. I think that he developed it that way because that was his personal experience of his mother and his father, and he doesn't necessarily mean that it has to be, this is the man's role, this is the woman's role, and, you know, in some families it could be that what he calls his father's role could be you know, what that family's mother does and vice versa, or both parents can really participate in both aspects of the way that he develops this. But you'll see that he talks about it as father and mother. I think that was his personal experience with his parents. I don't think it necessarily has to be that way. That's sort of a word of introduction. So let's see what he says here. So this is a piece, again, of his Hespid from 1977. So he says, people are mistaken in thinking that there is only one Masorah and one Masorah community, the community of the fathers. It's not true. We have two Masorot, two traditions, two communities, two Shalshalot HaKabbalah, the Masorah community of the fathers and that of the mothers. Thus shalt thou say to the house of Jacob and tell the children of Israel, Ko Tamar LeBeit Yaakov V'Tageid LeBnei Yisrael. Famously, that's why Beis Yaakov is Beis Yaakov, because Rashi in that pasuk, quoting the Medrash, actually says that, why did it have to say Beit Yaakov and B'nai Yisrael? Because it's talking about the women and the men, right? So Beit Yaakov is talking about the women. So the Rav here is also saying that there's the community of the fathers, the community of the mothers. Same thing that he sees in Mishlei. Hear, my son, the instruction of thy father, Musar Avicha, and forsake not the teaching of thy mother, Torat Imecha. Shma b'ni Musar Avicha, v'al titosh Torat Imecha. Counsel of the old king. What is the difference between those two Masorot, traditions? What is the distinction between Musar Avicha and Torat Imecha? Let us explore what one learns from the father and what one learns from the mother. One learns much from the father, how to read a text, the Bible or the Talmud, how to comprehend, how to analyze, how to conceptualize, how to classify, how to infer, how to apply. One also learns from father what to do and what not to do, what is morally right and what is morally wrong. Father teaches the son the discipline of thought as well as the discipline of action. Father's tradition is an intellectual moral one. That is why it is identified with Musar, which is the biblical term for discipline. What is Torat Imecha? What kind of Torah does the mother pass on? And I admit that I am not able to define precisely the Masoretic role of the Jewish mother. Only by circumscription I hope to be able to explain it. Permit me to draw upon my own experiences. I used to have long conversations with my mother. In fact, it was a monologue rather than a dialogue. She talked and I happened to overhear. What did she talk about? I must use a halachic term in order to answer this question. She talked me'inyanei d'yoma. I used to watch her arranging the house in honor of a holiday. I used to see her recite prayers. I used to watch her recite the Sedra every Friday night. And I still remember the nostalgic tune. I learned from her very much. Most of all, I learned that Judaism expresses itself not only in formal compliance with the law, but also in a living experience. She taught me that there is a flavor, a scent, and a warmth to mitzvot. I learned from her the most important thing in life, to feel the presence of the Almighty and the gentle pressure of his hand resting upon my frail shoulders. Without her teachings, which quite often were transmitted to me in silence, I would have grown up a soulless being, dry and insensitive. The laws of Shabbat, for instance, were passed on to me by my father. They are part of Musar Avicha. The Shabbos as a living entity, as a queen, was revealed to me by my mother. It is part of Torat Imecha. The fathers knew much about the Shabbos. The mothers lived the Shabbos, experienced her presence, and perceived her beauty and splendor. The fathers taught generations how to observe the Shabbos. Mothers taught generations how to greet the Shabbos and how to enjoy her 24-hour presence. So that, every time I read it, and I've read it many times now, it's always very powerful to me. It emphasizes the idea that there's an experience to mitzvot, and it's not just about the technical details, checking those off the list. And if you send a messenger to do it for you, even if technically you accomplish the action that needs to be accomplished, you're missing out on that experience. And that experience is an equally important part of what mitzvot are getting at. And I think this piece from the Rav really emphasized that. And for the Rav, he actually viewed this emotional experiential component as, for some mitzvot, as part of the halachic requirements of many mitzvot. Not really extra to the halacha, but an essential part, an essential component of fulfilling the mitzvah. So there's another piece also I didn't put on the sheet where he develops this, where he talks about, I don't know if anyone's seen it, where he talks about it's the Erev Shabbos Jew, right? Where, or maybe this isn't the Rav's piece, but sort of there's the Arab Shabbos Jew, like the getting excited for Shabbos and the sort of like having that mood, he felt like was really sort of lost in the community that he saw around him in America, and he really like laments that. I think it's really coming from the same place, that there's a certain experience that we're supposed to create surrounding mitzvot that's not just fulfilling the technical details. So, it's also, so we see that that applies to mitzvot, that there's a value in creating that experience, and therefore it sort of makes sense why mitzvah bo yoter mibishlucho. It's better if you do it yourself, because then you're able to participate and create that experience for yourself. And we see that this is proven also in general in life, that creating experiences around activities and not just checking things off a list, not just like checking responsibilities off a list, really can further and deepen relationships. So if we look at source 13, this is a quote from the Gottman Institute relationship blog. John Gottman wrote a book called The Seven Principles of Making Marriage Work. He has what he calls his love lab in Seattle, where he's a psychologist, a researcher, and he basically talks about how he can sort of like predict whether couples are going to like stay together or not based on like these principles that he outlines in his book. So this is a quote from his blog. He says, relationships aren't just about date nights, weekend getaways, and making love. They can also have a spiritual dimension that has to do with creating an inner life together, a culture rich with symbols and rituals, and an appreciation for your roles and goals that link you. Another way to create shared meaning, and that's one of his principles of his seven, is create shared meaning. That's what he says that you need to do in order to create a deep, meaningful, lasting relationship. He says another way to create shared meaning is to create traditions and rituals for your life together as a couple. Start by talking to each other about the kinds of traditions and rituals that you each had when you were growing up. What are your best and worst memories? What would have made them better? What are these rituals like for you today? What do they mean or symbolize to you? How would you like them to be now? Share each of your past experiences with these traditions and create special ones of your own for this year and for many years to come. And he's saying here that really creating experiences together, creating traditions, creating these moments, creating experiences surrounding activities that you're going to do deepens your relationship. That creates shared meaning, and that deepens your relationship in an ongoing way. He actually says in a chapter of his book, he says, none of the footage taped in our love lab would win anybody an Oscar. Right? He says, it's not that exciting. He says, our archives are filled with scenes in which the husband looks out the picture window and says, wow, look at that boat. And the wife peers over her magazine and says, yeah, it looks like that big schooner we saw last summer, remember? And the husband grunts. Right? He's saying, like, it's not exciting, it's not, right? He says, what he sees in his love lab and what he predicts is going to be successful relationships are not necessarily these relationships that are so exciting and so there's so much, you know, drama and fireworks. But he says it's the couples that are sort of like sharing this every day, but in a way that's sort of doing these principles that he outlines, one of which is this creating shared meaning, which is really, like I think the Rav emphasized with mitzvah and with our relationship with God, is sort of having an experience around an activity and not just sort of like going through the motions of the activity. And that's what I think this principle is really getting at if we say that it's about everything. It's a broad principle. It applies to all mitzvot, that it's about really creating experiences around mitzvot and not just sort of checking obligations off the list. Now, if we say that this principle, like the Chacham HaTzumah wants to say, is really just about Shabbos and Kiddushin, about Shabbos and marriage, then maybe it says something about the nature of those two mitzvot in particular. That those are, right, maybe these are particular mitzvot which specifically require great personal investment, more so than others, right? And I think Shabbos is really paradigmatic and emblematic of our relationship with God. It represents our covenant with God from the beginning of time, right? We say over and over again on Shabbos, Zecher L'maaseh B'Reishit, that we're commemorating creation of the world, and also from Yitzhak Mitzrayim, where we formed as a nation and connected with God as a nation, where we say also over again on Shabbos, Zecher L'Yitzhak Mitzrayim. And we can't just pawn that off on somebody else. We have to actively engage ourselves in affirming and reaffirming that covenant each week. And if you look at the next source on your sheet, it's from the Shabbos Project website. And I think it really emphasizes this idea, that the power of Shabbat, this is source 14 on the back page, keeping it together is also an allusion to the unique restorative powers, the opportunity for deep physical, emotional, and spiritual rejuvenation that the full Shabbat experience affords. This is especially relevant in a modern world in which we are bombarded with technology and gadgetry. Shabbat enables us to set aside time to revisit and reinvigorate our most important relationships with God, with our families and friends, and with our inner selves. Through Shabbat, we keep it, our lives, together. So we can't just, that's not something that we can experience if we have someone else do it for us. Right? Obviously, like the Gemara is talking about a very sort of like technical example of, you know, getting the food ready for Shabbos, but I think we can sort of like look at it in a, you know, a bigger way, that that's not something that we can have someone else do for us. We're going to miss out on that experience if we send a messenger to do it for us. That's why it's maybe specifically for that mitzvah, it's really important that we do it ourselves in order to be able to experience that restorative power that that Shabbos really allows us. And so too with marriage and relationships with other human beings, maybe marriage being paradigmatic of that, we have to personally invest ourselves in relationships in order to get the most out of them. If we sort of like, you know, I talk about this with my friends or say this to my students, like when you're, you know, my students, when your parents ask you that, you know, like every day, how was your day when you get home from school, like you don't really want to answer them. You kind of just want to go upstairs and like do your own thing. But you have to be there. You have to like have the conversations even when you're not in the mood in order to really have a relationship. You can't just send someone else to do it, right? You can't just sort of like have, you know, your brother who walked in the door say like, oh, she got a bad grade on her test or she got a good grade on her test. That's not connecting. That's not going to allow for that relationship. So, and I think that it's, for each of us, we have to sort of think about our own lives and our own families and our own routines and our own traditions and really try to come up with these ideas of how to create experiences around the different parts of our daily lives and around the different parts of our routine, whether that's in Torah and mitzvot and our relationships with God, or whether that's about with our spouses or with our children or our families in general. That's what I think allows us to create meaningful relationships that continue on a, you know, day to day on a daily basis, and not only in times of, you know, spiritual loftiness or times, unfortunately, of stress, but to maintain that on a daily basis. Like, for example, a few years ago, when this winter, we haven't had any snow days from school, but I'm a teacher, so I like snow days. But a few years ago, the blizzard was over the weekend, it was during winter break, it didn't get me any snow days. But a few years ago, there were a lot of snow days, so we sort of created like our family ritual around snow days, right? We would get up in the morning, we'd have, you know, we'd make pancakes, like, you know, not frozen pancakes, we'd make real pancakes for breakfast, and then we would go get all dressed up and bundled up and go out and play in the snow, and we'd come back in and we'd have hot chocolate, and then my husband and my son would take all the like chairs from the apartment and all the blankets and pillows from the couch and build like a big tent, and they'd play in the tent for a while. And that sort of became like our snow day routine, our snow day ritual, to the point where like when it was the next snow day, my 2-year-old sort of like knew exactly what to do. And that was sort of like, that was our experience of snow days. And I think that really did create like a certain bond and a certain connection between like the different members of my family, because that was something that we sort of shared, that experience. So I think it's those types of things that we're talking about that can really help maintain relationships on a day to day and not just in times of, you know, more extreme experiences, like, you know, taking the girls to the campsite and putting, you know, making them do an escape room or orienteering, where you sort of create like an intense bonding experience. But we can create those, we can maintain that sort of level of bonding in our daily lives by creating experiences surrounding the activities that we're doing in our daily lives. So my hope is that for each of us, we can enrich our lives spiritually by creating these traditions and memories and experiences around halacha and ritual that help what could otherwise be something dry and technical really come alive and become meaningful. Like, I think music is also something that really helps with this. I know, like, for example, like playing like Shabbos music in the house on Friday afternoon when you're cooking for Shabbos, that could be something that sort of like creates an association among your whole family of like what this experience is about. I know for me that's something that is meaningful. I know some people are not music people. But I think that music definitely has something to be, you know, has the potential to help with this idea. But again, everyone has to think for yourself what works for you. So I think hopefully we can all sort of try to create experiences that enrich our lives in this way. But we can also appreciate that incorporating, right, the value of routine, the message of the Korban Tamid, that incorporating and try to find meaning in that in and of itself, of incorporating God into our daily lives. Even when we don't find a particular practice that we're doing particularly meaningful or special or spiritual, we can find meaning in the fact that we're there, we're being present, and we're incorporating God and the people we love into our lives on a daily basis. So thank you so much for joining me tonight. I look forward to other opportunities to learn today. If anyone has any questions, I'll be happy to take questions. But I'm going to shut this off.